Welcome back to episode 95 of Chess Journeys, Tales of a Dull Improvement. Here on Chess Journeys, we seek to not only glorify ratings gains, which are great, but we also dive into the plateaus and perhaps below that even, the pits of despair. If you want to support the show, you can go to Patreon Chess Journeys. And I want to thank Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Donald Rich Burgess, Brandon Halsey, David Driver, Lindsay Newhall, and Jeff Peterson. I have been streaming quite a bit on Dr. Skull_Tiny Grimes. Lately, I've been trying to put my knowledge into skill and been playing more fast, rapid, slow blitz. I don't know how you want to describe that. If you want to appear on the show, you can fill out the Google form in the show notes. We all want to hear your story. And today, I bring to you the first grandmaster to ever appear on Chess Journeys. I was never sure I'd speak to a grandmaster in my entire life, but have the opportunity today. He is the writer of the popular and informative Next Level Chess blog. He's a producer of Next Level Training, a complete chess course designed to provide direct tools and plans for improvement. And in fact, he has graciously given us a link to use that you can see in the show notes and a code Chess Journeys to get 20% off of this course if you are moved to do so after the interview. But beware, it's a limited time only. I think it's like 7 days. So when you hear it, use it if you want to use it. So, Grandmaster Noel Studer, welcome to the show, and have you had a chance to play any chess yet today?
Thank you very much for having me, Kevin, and I haven't played any chess today. No, I don't even know if I played any chess last week.
So. This is very different than my other guests who are always like, I knew that question was coming, and I played 7 rapid games today, so this is a great place to start, right? Noel is no longer an active chess player, right? You are a retired grandmaster.
Absolutely, yeah. So 2 years ago, August 2021 was the last time I've played official federated game. And ever since then, I have been fully focused on creating content for chess improvers and coaching some people ranging from beginners to grandmasters.
Interesting. Do you just play for fun at all, or is it just kind of like, it's hard for me to just drop in and play a fun game without practicing?
Actually, I do sometimes, but mostly I have to say I regret it, because mostly it's like a way of procrastinating. I'm writing something and it's not so easy, and I'm like, okay, let's just fire up a blitz game, and 2 hours later I played 15 blitz games and none of them really good. So I really try to limit it as much as possible.
Okay. So it sounds like in some ways playing chess for you is a negative, because it actually takes you away from what you're really striving to do right now.
Yeah. I mean, if let's say there were friends visiting and we would take out a chessboard and trash talk and have some fun and play, that would be amazing. Like, I'm still a fan of this, but just randomly during the day, when I have more difficult things to do, it's usually a negative, and it usually shows that I either don't feel that well or I want to procrastinate on things that are more important but tougher to do.
Oh, that's fair. And when you say friends coming over, I assume you mean chess friends, not just like regular people in the world who are like, I will take you down, Grandmaster Studer, and then you talk trash to them the whole time. That sounds great.
No, I don't do that. Yeah, it's fun because I recently started playing poker, and sometimes when I see people, you know, playing chess on their phones or checking some stuff, I say, do you play chess? And they, yeah, let's play together, blah, blah, blah. And I always have to find a way. Like, I don't want to usually say that I'm a grandmaster, and then all these questions start coming in, and you're not just the random guy at the poker table anymore. But so I need to either just not ask the question at all, or I'm like, yeah, sometimes I play from time to time or something like
that. All right, let me give you the answer. You invent a new persona. You're a 1400 chess player from Oklahoma who's just working on their game. There you go.
I think that's great. I will use that next time.
Okay. I want to make a little comment here. I don't know if this is going to sound weird to you, but I stopped playing chess about 20 years ago after a quick 2-year run. And when I stopped, I felt like grandmasters were almost like these mythical creatures. Like, I never imagined in my life that I would speak to one. And I would go to these big giant tournaments, and I wouldn't even look directly at them. They were like the sun, right? Like, you can kind of sideways glance at them, but I didn't want to be caught looking at a grandmaster. So it's a big honor for me to have this opportunity to talk to you. Do you feel like there's been this shift in like the way the reverence of grandmasters over the last 20 years or so?
I mean, first of all, I'm happy that you got to speak to a grandmaster, and I hope the experience will be nice. I think like sometimes for myself, it's right. I don't perceive it that way because especially when I was still active, I was comparing myself with even stronger grandmasters. So I wasn't that special because I was comparing myself to the Geary and Carlsons of the world. And I was like, oh, I'm actually much worse than them. Right. Right. For me, those are the guys I was like, oh, my God, when I'm at the same tournament, I get a little bit nervous. So when I stopped and I started to interact much more with amateurs, I started to realize like, oh, it's actually something special that I achieved. It was really like the first time I think I really appreciated that it's not just a given, because once you are in those shoes and you have the grandmaster title, it's like normal for you, right? So this was a little bit a shift for me just to see it from the other's perspective. And as well, if I start to play poker, I think the same thing for me, right? All these big names in a poker, I'm like, oh my God, or there's a pro at my table. What am I doing? How should I talk to this guy? And he's probably thinking the exact same thing as me, like, just talk to me. I'm a normal dude. Just there's nothing so special about myself. So it's fun to see both perspective at the same time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I had your FIDE page up, and I have an 8-year-old daughter who plays chess. And she was like, he's the 332nd best player in the whole world? I was like, yeah, he's really good. She was like, that's insane. She was very impressed by you. Very impressed.
That's cool. Cheers to your daughter.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you a question I ask a lot of people, because I think it's going to be very different for you, which is like, what was your chess journey like? Like for most people, it's like, well, I saw the Queen's Gambit and it motivated me to play. I'm going to assume you did not start with the Queen's Gambit. I think you started earlier.
Yeah, I think I stopped with the Queen's Gambit, right?
The rare Queen's Gambit
I'm just
killer.
Doing everything the wrong way around, probably, but... So I started when I was in kindergarten age. I actually don't know which exact age, but I just, you know, started saying kindergarten and I like it. So I started playing with my father, and then there was like every holiday we had some kid programs, and one program was playing chess for 1 week. So I visited that program, and the coach there said, you're not that bad. Maybe you want to visit the club. And that's how I started. And I started visiting the club, you know, training once a week just with all the kids, playing some regional rapid tournaments for kids. And then at some point, you know, added one training and started to go to national tournaments. And one big breakthrough for me was the first year that I took it a little bit more serious, where I had a coach and I was doing maybe, you know, 5 hours a week, 4 hours a week, something like that. I immediately qualified not only for the Swiss Championship, but later on for the European Championship. And that was like, as a 11-year-old kid, it's just so cool that you can go to Montenegro, to a completely different place, and go with the national team. Back then, my father came the first time, but then ever since, I always just went with the national team, which was so cool. Wow. And that's how I started, and I just kept going. I went to a sports class in high school. I had 1 year more of high school, but I had more time to take to train. And after high school, I decided to become a professional chess player. That was in 2015. And then I did that for 6 years. And in 21, I stopped. And now I'm coaching.
Okay. I'm curious about, like, when you were a kid, did someone, like, label you as a prodigy at some early age, or are you just a kid that kind of liked chess and was like taking it kind of easy until it reached some point where it was like you on your own were like, actually, now that I'm, you know, 10 or something, I want to take this really seriously?
It was actually funny because I think I was the first time number one in my age group only at 16 or 17. So I wasn't the Swiss prodigy they were looking forward to. We were four that were pretty good, but I was always, as I started the latest, some of them were already with eight at European Championships. And back then I didn't even play a national tournament or regional tournament. So they had like some some advance compared to me, and I had to make that up. So I was rather the interested kid that wasn't that bad, but not really what people thought would end up as the youngest GM of our country.
Gotcha. So you weren't the great national hope to lead Switzerland to the promised land of chess glory.
Absolutely not. I actually remember that we had two national coaches at some point, and one of them was also private coach of one of my competitors.
Ooh.
And he said that I couldn't even calculate two moves ahead or something like this. So he really said like I was really, really bad. And yeah, turns out I wasn't that bad, but I also don't perceive myself as this huge prodigy, and everything was clear that I would just always become a GM, but I define myself more through, understanding how to improve something. And I think that also shows in my teaching, that I have a easier time comprehend when things aren't going that well, because if you're just a prodigy and everything went so easily for yourself, I think it's hard to like understand, okay, this guy has problem at 1500. For me, I started having problem at 2600, right? So for some people, it's way too much. And I had barriers already early on in my career, and that helps me actually for the coaching.
Yeah, because yeah, it's the same thing with teaching. I think the best teachers are the ones that sort of struggle as students, so they can really understand what it's like when students are struggling. What was it like learning as a kid? Like, it's one of these things that as adults, most of the people on my show have like these clear plans that they're working with and trying really hard to get better with limited time. Were you the kid that I sort of imagined that's just kind of like, I just play a bunch of chess and then I magically get better because that's how kids get better? Or did you also have like a training program when you were a kid?
I was quite unorganized. So I would say my chess journey would be split in two steps. First step was until 18, when I became a grandmaster, a professional player. So until then, my chess training was quite random. I had the privilege of working with coaches like Artur Yusupov. So I had the influence of strong coaches, but I wasn't really determined. I was rather lazy. I liked to spend time on chess, but didn't like to do the hard thing. Then when I had big, plateaus, I understood, okay, probably I have to invest a little bit more, but I was the guy trying to do as little as possible to get better. And then at some point when I was thinking about getting, professional, I also had to professionalize my training, and I started writing training plans. I started trying to, get sponsors, get my career going in a way which needed some different kind of planning and different kind of intensity also when doing chess training than what I did before.
Was this like quite a bit older, at like 16, 15, that kind of age?
It was. So in 2014, when I wasn't 18 yet, so I'm in October, so it was a little bit earlier, but close to my 18th birthday. Wait. 2000, what did I say? Yeah, 2014. Yeah, 18th birthday. Okay, that's right. Sometimes I forget how old I am. So around my 18th birthday, I was able to fight for the world championship title under 18. Last game, I was trailing by 1 point, and a draw was enough for third place, and I rejected the draw. I wanted to fight for the win. I lost, I got fifth. But that was the first time I really appreciated that also internationally, I could do some big things. I was really playing with the best of the best in my age group, and that was motivating. And that was where things started to click, because in a way, I never believed. Already in Switzerland, I had trouble being the best, right? So I never believed that I could do anything internationally. And that's when I started to like feel as a sportsman, I would say, and feel like, okay, with the right training, with the right effort, I can go quite far. And that's where the motivation came in also to structure my training. So at 18 years old.
Okay, interesting. Do you remember who finished ahead of you in that event?
Yeah, it was actually Bortnik. I think many listeners might remember him. He is a very strong, fast bullet blitz player. Also streams occasionally, I think. So wow. Yeah, he offered me a draw on move 7. I declined and resigned on move 22 or something like that. So it wasn't a long pain.
Wow, that's too bad. Do you know who won that event? Do you remember?
Yeah, he did. He did.
He, oh, so he went on to win the whole thing.
He was 1 point ahead of me, and I just had to beat him to have any chance.
Gotcha.
And with a draw, he was basically secured the world championship title, and I would have had a sure third place. But I wasn't happy about third and wanted to win, and he punished me.
I kind of feel like the difference between third and fifth isn't that big, whereas the difference between third and first is, like, absolutely massive.
Yeah, you can see it from two sides, right? A medal is a medal. That's what usually is talked about, right? Because fifth, nobody... Like, I would say fifth and 20th, there's really no difference at all, basically from sponsoring point of view and so on. So a medal would have been something, especially because it was would have been the first medal for 40 years in Swiss chess history or something. So it would have been a really big thing.
Yeah.
There was a part of me, but for me it was quite clear. Like, if I can fight for a world championship title, that will probably be the only time, because I was already then as realistic to understand that, okay, I won't be number five in the world probably, and be able to fight for the, you know, real world championship title. But a youth world championship title would have been very nice, so I tried. But it was a good learning opportunity.
Yeah, it sounds like a great experience. It's fun to hear about sort of the kid approach, right? So we just don't get that much on this podcast. It's all about adults wrestling with their own improvement. Let's shift a bit into adult improvement. And I guess I just want to ask you this first big question, which is, like, what motivates you to focus on adult improvement? Why not just work with, you know, the upcoming chess prodigies and then just train them exclusively? Because, like, you spend all this time writing a blog about adult improvement. You work with adults. You're very positive and supportive on Twitter. So what motivates you to do that?
I just get so much out of it. I think it's very nice to work with people who appreciate the work you do. And also, I've lived for 6 years in this professional chess scene, and I wasn't too happy with how things went with FIDE, with all this competitive spirit, me against you, with some prearranged draws. And I have none of that when I work with adults. I have people that are fascinated by the game. They want to improve. They really listen to what you're telling them. They mostly don't have pre-made judgments about training routines. So it's just something I really enjoy. I also do some work with very strong players. So I was at the European Club Cup, for example, with FC Bayern Munich, the chess team, and there were some grandmasters on that team as well. So I like to sometimes do that, but I just prefer working with people that aren't doing chess professionally.
Okay, interesting. I've heard you talk about this in other places, so I don't think this is a big secret. You mentioned before in other places that one of the reasons why you stopped competing was that you had some sort of brain injury. I was wondering if you feel like that puts you in a unique position to understand the challenge of adult improvers, because it sounds like one of the great limitations was that enforced upon you, like, much more or much greater limits on your time, that you could only spend so much time, which actually sort of puts you in the same boat that most adult improvers have with chess, is that hard limit of, like, I would love to spend 10 hours a day studying chess, but instead I have 40 minutes. Help me get better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's basically spot on, because in 2017, I had this brain injury and I managed to improve my rating still by close to 100 points or 100 points. And I would say I had maybe 2 to 3 hours really focused every day in average. Like, first year was much worse, but then that's where I was at for most of the time. Actually, also my blog, my business, I build up with around 3 hours on average every day, with 2 days off every week. So that's not too much time. So I think I got forced, as you say, to get really good at understanding what matters and then to put time there and just leave out so many things. So, for example, I can relate to the fear of missing out, but I was just forced to understand that you need to say no to things, because as a professional, I have professional friends. They would study 8 to 10 hours a day. And I just had absolutely no chance to compete with them if I wouldn't be much smarter and much more strict with my training routine. And also that's where I started to learn about mindset, about, you know, how to perform the best during day X. So all these things came because I couldn't do that much chess work. So I had to get very good at everything else, basically.
Yeah, that I heard you talking about that, the fear of missing out on your chess training course, which we'll get into in a minute. And that resonated so much with me. And so, no, I have to ask you this. I'm listening to Ben Johnson's Perpetual Chess podcast. Someone comes on there. They start talking about this book. It sounds amazing. They say it helped them gain 200 points. How am I supposed to resist this?
I think the solution is to have a great training plan already in place. That was always my solution. So when you are clear on where you want to go, where you stand, and what you need to go, where you want to go, you already have that in place. Everything that comes from outside is much easier to say no to. But when you don't really have a plan and you're just wandering a little bit around, then everything that sounds good will be a shiny object that you basically can't say no to, right? So you will jump from one thing to another. You will try it out. Oh, it didn't just work. And thing is, usually you don't see it immediately, like in 2-3 weeks that things work. You need the time. So you really need to give your training some time to show results. And for myself, it's the same. For example, in poker, right? I try to really get better at poker. But when I'm unorganized, I think, okay, yeah, there is this new whatever tool. Oh, let's buy this thing or let's get this course. And then I realize I actually didn't finish that other course. I didn't do that. I didn't do this. And I just start getting other things because I'm not organized and I have somewhere to hope to get better, but I'm not really, focused on what I really need to do. So that's what I realize also with many students and also students of the course, that once they know what they have to do to get better, they don't find it as hard anymore to just say no to new opening courses or new books.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great challenges for adult improvers is like coming up with a plan. Like I can come up with a plan, but then to be confident that my plan is the right plan and that I should say no to this, like, you know, like the first time I heard about Yusupov's books, it was like guaranteed get to 2000 when you finish these. I was like, well, that's better than my plan, right? And then someone goes on Perpetual Chess and is like, I gained 200 points from this one book. And I'm like, well, that's even better than that other promise. So I don't know. It's challenging, Noel. Luckily, you have a solution for us, which we'll get to in a bit. And maybe this will be motivating for people. Next question I have, though, is you said on Twitter recently, stop using age as an excuse. Now, as an old man myself, I'm curious, how far do you take this? Do you really think age doesn't matter? Or are you just kind of saying, like, just do the best you can and don't worry about age?
I think do the best you can is already a great start. And I have, you know, I always thought like, okay, I'm in my 20s. How can I, you know, say, okay, you're old is an excuse, right? That doesn't sound so convincing. But then I had this one interaction or this one training I did with a 70-year-old gentleman. And we started working and he was also convinced he would not get better. His goal was not getting worse, right? He said, just help me not getting worse. And so we started working when he was like rated 1630, Swiss national rating. 1 year later, he played a tournament, his first international tournament, and he performed 1850, I believe. And my favorite game of that tournament was when he played for 5.5 hours and he tricked an 8-year-old kid, which was the big prodigy of Switzerland.
Oh,
wow. We rated 1800 in a stalemate because he was so tenacious. And he was 3 pawns down in a rook ending and he made the other guy stalemate him. And I was so happy because it was like worlds turned around, right? It should be the young kid tricking the older guy, but it was the old guy tricking the young kid. And that was so beautiful. And we only worked 1.5 hours every month together. And he just followed some small plan that we did. He had some time, obviously he was retired. So he studied some chess, but he didn't do that much. But we just focused on what's important. We thought about, okay, he can't focus that good anymore. What can we do to increase his focus? What can we do to make things easier for him? So the whole idea was just getting simpler decisions. And this is where I understood, okay, maybe he didn't get that much better at chess, but he got much better at playing chess. So I think everybody can do that. And already if you think like your sleep, your fitness, your what you eat, all these things, they make so much difference already. So even if you don't learn anything in chess, you can still, I would say nearly everybody listening to this podcast can still win 100 points without studying any chess. Just by being disciplined, like I'm eating well, I'm fit, I take a day off before a game I play maybe. You know, all these things can help so much to just get better decisions at the board.
Okay, wow. That's pretty amazing. We should make a movie about this guy. I think Neil Bruce will put up the funding for it as the chess godfather. Great. Okay, next question on my list of 1,000 questions. I saw you tweet about how great the STEPS program was recently, and I had tried it once before. What I didn't realize is that you could find the answers online. And so I was like, I like flipped to the end of the book and I was like, where are the answers? And so I just kind of gave up on it, but I started again. And I'm using book 4 and I found it quite easy so far. So I have two questions. The first one is, what do you think makes the STEP method so great? And then I guess the second question is more selfish, which is like, should I continue on with book 4? It's in my supposed rating range. Or should I maybe skip to book 5? So I guess let's start with, why do you think the STEPS method is so great? Because when you look at it, it's a pretty boring book, man. It is not flashy.
Yeah, that's what I also say in my course, right? I think the description is like, if you don't mind a really boring old book, then this is great. If you want to be entertained, don't buy the STEP method. So we talked about this importance of having a plan, right? To have a plan, it's so important that things are simple. If it's too complex, if you have, you know, 7 different books you need to study, you know, these tiny little details you need to remember, you will never do your training. So I love the STEP method because it's pretty darn simple, right? It's nothing special. There are just pages, exercises, and you just download the PDF and look at the examples. So what I also like about this way of not having the solutions in the book is you don't get tempted to check, right? So one temptation, especially with online trainers, is you see a move that is good and you just move it and you see, okay, it didn't work. Let's try the other one. So that's not what you can do during the game. So that's not how you should train. In the STEP method, you cannot even turn around the page and watch the solution. So what happens sometimes, at least when I solve exercises, is I saw a line, I didn't fully calculate it, but it seemed promising. I was like, let's look the solution. Rook c2, true. And then there are like 5 more moves that I obviously missed, but I'm happy about myself. And I solved it. So that's what shouldn't happen. So with the STEP method, you really get forced into writing down the solution, because if not, you will forget it. Right? You solve, let's say, a full page. You always write down the solution. And then you look at the PDF and you go through all the solutions and you can compare what you wrote down with the official solution. So that's one point. And another point is, it's just so tested. It's very famous in Europe. In basically every chess club in Switzerland, we have it. I did hundreds, probably thousands of exercises of the STEP method. And those are tested puzzles, which really work. And it's a good buildup. And the books have similar rating levels throughout the book. So it's not jumping from very hard to very easy to very hard to very easy. It's and that's why I like them a lot.
Okay. Any thoughts for me if I'm getting like 11 out of 12 on each page and it's not taking me too long? Is that actually the right answer? Or should I be striving for a book where I can only get like 8 out of 12 and it takes me even longer?
Question is, how much time do you take? And is right answer, does it mean that you saw everything that is outlined in the solution?
Yes, I'm seeing everything that's outlined. So most of them are pretty quick, but this is kind of I guess another follow-up question, which is like, if you tell me, hey, Kevin, there's an answer to a puzzle. Also, it's a luring puzzle. Like, how could I not get it? Like, it has to be like the hardest puzzle ever to not get it. Cause I'm like, okay, well, I know there's only like three even possibilities that could lead to a luring type solution. So I guess another question is like the thematic approach, which is part of steps. I don't know. I'm torn. Like, I find it kind of hollow as a testing measure, but maybe it's more like you're doing layups and you just keep doing layups until you're the master of layups. And then the test is the game. I don't know, Noel. What do you think?
So I think that's a good bookmark, which I want to come back to the five steps to go from not knowing a tactical motive to mastering it during the game. So maybe you can remind me if I forget about it. I try to tackle the other questions first. So a good way of having a book that tests you is being somewhere between 60 and 80% of completely correct solutions. I ask this question because sometimes people think that if they just see the first move, that's correct. In my book, it's really writing down and seeing all possible counterattacks from the opponents and seeing why they don't work. That's correct. If you miss on move two, a possible and a smart idea from the opponent, it's actually a wrong solution because during the game, you might get punished, right? In the puzzle, you know it will probably work out. During the game, it might just be the losing move if you miss that. So that's the first point, 60 to 80%, because you want to have something that actually is hard. So you need to get some things wrong. And then you also asked if you should move on. I think you can try one of two things. Either you can do the workbook mix, which is every step has a workbook. I think that's where everything is organized, like luring, x-ray, fork, whatever. And then you have workbook mix where you have the same ideas, but you don't know where you're at. Okay, so you get it a little bit more difficult. As you say, if you know already it's luring, it is much easier. But that's a little bit harder, even though the puzzles might be the same difficulty, just you not knowing it is a little bit harder. Or the other thing you can do is just go one step further and see where you're at. The great thing is also, I think they cost like $5 a piece. Yeah. So they are really inexpensive and you can really try it out. And I think one thing I also had to learn myself is don't feel bad about lying down a bad book and just taking another one. Now, this is not bad, but it's maybe not aimed at you, right? We have, as you said, we have so little time. I realize that with books, general books, I love to read. But even if I read a book a week, I won't finish all the great books in this world, even if I live until 80. Like, there are so many amazing books. So if something is not captivating you and you're feeling like, nah, this is not too special or this is not my level, right? It should simply not be that you're lazy and it's hard, it works, but you're lazy and you just put it away and you take again the book you love. But if there's something that doesn't work, don't worry, just put it away. Maybe you come back to it later, but it's no shame to not finish a book.
It's interesting you say that because I'm thinking like, if I did these exact same puzzles in a mixed format, they would be hard. Like, they're hard puzzles for me, but it's just because if you tell me like, hey, this is exactly what you're looking for. So I don't know, maybe I'll try the mixed book, but my guess is when I do the mixed book, I'll be like, what? No, they're impossible. I can't do any of them. So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
I think they work together. Maybe it's a good point to go through these five steps. So the five steps are: step number one, you learn a new motive. Okay? So somebody, either this book, right? There is a manual which can teach you also all these motives. So you see it for the first time and somebody tells you, I say, hey, Kevin, here is the Anastasia's checkmate. That's how it works. You put a knight on E2, then you sacrifice on the H file. And on the H file, checkmate. That's how it is. And second step is I just give you puzzles and I tell you that's the Anastasia's checkmate. It's not that hard, right? But you just need to get the reps in. You need to feel how it is to do it yourself. To maybe they will get a little bit more difficult. You will go from further away. Maybe you need to lure a queen away that is protecting the E7 square. And only then you can give a check and then a checkmate and so on. So you do that. Then you... Again, next step is doing tactical exercises. So you know there is a tactic, but you don't know the motive. That would be workbook mix. So that's, again, it's more difficult. You can have the same difficulty, but it will be tougher because you don't know, do I just have to win a knight over there or do I have to give a checkmate? It can be everything. Then step number four gets much more difficult. And I think this is the hardest to emulate in training and the one that nearly everyone skips, which is get a position that could be just a normal move or it could be a tactical win. So this isn't a position where you know tactics trainer online, I need to win this position, but it could just be developing your knight. So how I did that, I had the privilege of having a coach. He went through books, came up with own exercises, and I just got 12 exercises. And they ranged from checkmate in 7 to drawing an endgame to it looks like a move wins, but it actually loses and you need to find why it loses and then make a drawing move. So I just didn't know where I was at, which was very hard. It's very tough, but that's preparing you for the last step that you're during the game and you just find the best. So that's like the 5 steps you go through. So in a way, if you just do the step method, the normal workbook, you are on step number 2. If you do the mix, you are on step number 3. And then we need something more that is step number 4. And then we can use it in a game.
Okay. And also, just to be clear, Noel lays this out very clearly in the next level training program, which we'll get to in a moment. I just came up with a book idea, though, while we were talking. Let me know what you think of this. It's like you learn about a pattern, say like lures or something, and then you get a bunch of lures, and then the next page is a bunch of puzzles where half of them the lure works and half of them the lure loses. And so you have to like figure out like, wait, is this really working or not? Because yeah, that seems to be like the problem of chess puzzle trainers, right? Is they all work. And then like even the woodpecker method, they're like, okay, there's like 4 of them that are red herrings. And you're like, okay, what if half of them work?
I think that would be great. That would already be a very good idea because we really need to get this feeling of understanding if something works or not, right? This spidey sense that sometimes we're talking about, right? That I as a grandmaster can maybe look at a position and I realize, okay, that's a position where things must work. I'm not always correct, but mostly I have the right feeling where maybe somebody else is looking at the position and they are starting to just look at the queen side where my focus just goes, okay, bishop takes h7 must work in this position. So how can we train this part of chess, right? I think that that's important. And I just want to shout out a book I also recommend in the course. I think it's called Practical Chess Exercises.
Yes.
600 of them.
Yeah.
So that's really like this step number 4 idea. And that's like nearly one of the only books I actually found. And I also want to, if you're at home and you're saying, no, I don't want this book or this book is not aimed at me. So what you can do is you can do that with friends. So you can send positions, like come up, take tactics books, take 4 positions from a tactic book, put them on a PDF, then take 4 position from a strategical book, put them in a PDF, and then 4 position maybe of your own blitz games, which are just normal moves or could be tactics, whatever. So something of everything. And then you send them to your friends and they have no clue how they should solve these positions. And your friend does the same. And let's say once every week, you exchange these puzzles, and that's a great way of creating this not knowing what to do. Hmm. And it can be a great way to challenge yourself with your friends if they are more or less on the same level. And it's also fun when you need to find good puzzles. You actually also activate something in your brain, like, is this really a good puzzle? Is it really the only move? Is it obvious? Is it not obvious? And you start to learn also just through putting these tests together for your friends.
That sounds like a great idea. Okay. Maybe we'll have to make the Chess Journeys Training Club. Although the Killer Chess Training Club might get upset by that. I don't know.
I think, I mean, it's just something everybody can use. So it's a fun idea.
Sounds amazing. Let's move on to talking more explicitly about your next level training program. Because something I've been using quite a bit lately. So I'll start here. No Studer here said, like, I have this new program. If you wouldn't mind taking a look at it, that'd be great. Or maybe I messaged you and asked you to look at it. I don't remember what the order there was, but so I have been looking at it. But I was having some hard times finding the time to do it because my schedule is very tight. But I made a huge revelation a week ago that I think will help all of you podcast listeners out there. You can actually treat it kind of like a podcast. So I started just listening to it on my way to work. And I was like, oh, now I easily have the time. Because while No Studer's face is wonderful, it's more, I feel like, talking than chessboard stuff. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are very little chessboards in this course. So the promise is, like, I show you how to train. I don't show you how to, like, you won't get much better at chess by doing the course, but your training will be so much better that later you will get much, much, much better at chess.
Yeah, so it was really great being able to listen to it. And I think what I appreciate most about the course is how specific you are. Like, a lot of people will say, like, you should do tactics and you should do X percentage of tactics in your program. But you have, like, a whole section, I don't know, what is it, like, an almost an hour long or something of just, like, how to do tactics. How you know, like you already explained the five steps, and then you talk about, like, you gave this big motivational thing about why you should write down your tactics, which was huge for me because I was always like, sure, man, I'm going to write down my tactics. And then I would do it once and I'd be like, that felt good, but it was annoying. So I'm not doing it again. But after hearing you really go into detail about why you should do it, I was much more motivated to do it. Though I do want to ask you this question. Why can't I keep doing it? Like, I will do it for a while. And then I'll be like, you know what, though? I'm in the mood not to do it. What's wrong with me? Why do I keep defaulting to not doing it?
Kevin, this will be a big revelation. You're a human being. And it sometimes sucks.
I wish I was a cyborg.
Because we are lazy. That's the problem, right? I know that the gym is helping me, but sometimes I just feel like, nah, today I'm not going to the gym. So that's, like, I think it's extremely important to sometimes just, there are some people that say, yeah, just training always fun. It's great. It's cool. You know, just do what you love and you'll get better. I'm not too much that type of guy. Like, I think there are things that work much better, but usually those are the things that aren't so fun, right? So we need to find techniques and ways to bring ourselves to make those things, right? So I'm very happy to hear that you said, okay, once I explained why you should write down the solutions, at least it got a little bit easier to write them down. So yeah, that's something I picked up from the great coach, Ramesh, Grandmaster, Indian Grandmaster. He sent me in an interview I did with him. He sent me, he always explains the students why they have to do things. Because you can't just say them, like, do tactics. Because you need to give them some kind of reason, and it needs to come from them. Like, they should understand, oh, I want to be a superstar in India, and connect that to solving tactics the right way. Once you get this connection done, like, it's much easier. So in a way, maybe if you have a goal in mind or a reason why you want to get better at chess, that's something you can remind yourself of when you get a little bit lazy to do the hard things, but those that work. And you can say, oh, actually, I want to be, I don't know, an example to my kid and show that even in my adult age, I can improve my chess tremendously, something like that, whatever it is for each person. And then you write that maybe down somewhere and you have it next to your chessboard and you look at it and you're like, okay, I know if I want to do that, I have to write down my solution. So somehow trick yourself to do the hard thing, because in the future, we'll be happy we have done it. But in the moment, it's so much easier to lie on your sofa, drink a beer, and watch some YouTube or any streamer you like.
Or even just do chess.com puzzles without writing it down. It's faster. You get the right answer faster. Yes, you miss more, but whatever. It's fine. You do more. Yeah, it's hard. I do have a puzzle journal. And whenever I write down my answers, this is what I tell myself. Noel Studer would be proud of you. You're doing the
right thing.
You have made it into my training program.
That's so cool. Yeah, that's really nice.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I don't always do it. But with the steps method, because there's no answers there, that's actually forced me to. I have to write down all my answers. So that's actually been a good thing. I've gone through 13 pages where wrote down every single answer, all the lines. So I think it's becoming more the norm for me now. We'll see. We'll see if I can make that shift.
So what you said also is if you do it more and it gets a habit, things get much easier, right? And then you just have to make sure that you don't break that habit. So again, for myself, it's going to the gym. I do it 5 weeks in a row, 3 times a week, always the same day, always in the morning. It starts to get automatical. If I leave for 1 week and I'm out and I come back and I didn't do gym right there, it's much harder already to go again Tuesday morning, gym. It starts to become a decision again. So the goal is really to have as many good habits as possible, because they don't need this brain energy convincing yourself and getting motivated, because it's just automatic.
Okay, then I have to ask this question now. You talked already about taking a break sometimes. I've seen you talk about taking breaks. Breaks scare me because I've made the habit. I've made the commitment of doing chess every day. I feel like if I took a break even for a day, or especially like 3 days, then there's this decent chance that the way my life works is I have to physically carve out time for chess. I'm worried that that time will get swallowed up by my life and I'll come back and be like, Jess, how did I ever make time for you? I'm scared. Are breaks really necessary? Should I be taking more of them? What do you think?
I think breaks are very important, but I do understand your fear. So I think we have to work around that. I think 1 day a week is already good. And what you have to do, again, we want to come up with a plan, right? The idea is that if you know Sundays are off for chess, you already know when and what you will do on Monday. That's extremely important, because if you take this break without knowing, then maybe you get lazy on Monday again and on Tuesday again, and you know, just everything is gone. But before you take a break, you want to know what you do when you come back. I do that for my business as well. If I'm in holidays for 2 weeks, I want to know what I'm doing the day when I come back, or the whole week when I come back, just to get myself into that mode again. If not, I know, as you say, I come back and I'm like, oh, it was so nice, holidays. Okay, today, 8:30, really 8:30? Nah, come on, let's start at 9:30. Maybe let's start with something easy. So we always have these ways of tricking ourselves. So knowing what you do after the break is very important. And why do you need a break? I think one of my students said it very well. He said, break is actually the best thing he could do for his chess, because he was so much more motivated every time he studied chess. And it was like a little, when he had to do things that really weren't that fun, but they worked, he said, okay, at least on Sunday, I don't have to do this. Like, at least on Sunday, I can get rid of all these stupid things Noel tells me to do, and I can do whatever I want. So it gives you this kind of safe haven as well if you do tough things, because you know, okay, I have a finish line in a way for this week. I can do whatever I want on this day. And then after, and then when you come back after a short break, even a day, I felt usually that the training was more intense and I was really looking forward to it. Like, you want to have this feeling of, oh, I want to study chess today. And you can do that by having these little breaks. If you just in one line, 365 days in a year, train chess, it's not that special anymore. But after a break, it can get special. It can be, you know, a cool activity, something you're looking forward to. And that's the reasoning I think breaks are extremely important.
Interesting. So are you saying my approach of like 800 straight days of chess might not have been the most optimal?
I think it's cool to say it, but I think there are things that work better. And okay. I mean, there are companies that have these streaks, right? So it's not that easy to just say, I break this streak. But I think somebody, maybe you saw that in our Discord group of the training program, somebody said they had like 1,000 days or something or more on a chess platform. And they said, I'm done with it. And they were so happy that they didn't continue this strike anymore because it was like a pressure. Like every day, even on a tournament, they felt like they had to log in and do something. And obviously on a tournament, it's not good to do this kind of work. You got to focus on your game. But it's like an addiction, right? It's like in a video game that you get this higher rank and oh my God, this flame gets bigger or people are commending me, you're so good. And people tell you, oh yeah, you work hard because you have this strike going on. So it's not so easy. You have to go a little bit against society, but I think slowly, slowly people are understanding and appreciating the power of breaks, be it in work on or in chess.
Okay, that sounds reasonable to me. I want to reflect real quick on one of my favorite parts of your next level training course, which when I was listening to it and when I'm listening to it, it feels like I'm getting a realistic approach to a training plan from a GM that gets it. And what I mean by this is there are other people, I don't want to name any names specifically, but there's a book I'm definitely thinking of that I read and I was like, wow, this is really great. This person really has a good idea of how to get good. And then the training plan was like, you just need 30 to 40 hours a week. And I was like, what? Like, what are you even talking about? Who's this written for? Like 9 other grandmasters? So it was a very weird moment to realize like that this person does have good ideas, but they're so disconnected from the reality of the world of an adult improver. I feel like that's what's really important about your course. Do you agree with that? Is that something you really focused on?
I think I know also the book you're talking about, and it's something I obviously researched and I tried to implement. So I'm happy to hear that because it really is focused on people trying to improve with limited time, right? That's the whole promise of it. I don't want people that are professional. Or, I mean, they can get the course, they will learn something, but it's not aimed at them. I also, you know, put this rough rating idea of 2000, right? Just to up to 2000, not from 2000, just to be very clear. Just to say that this is not aimed at people probably trying to become a GM or certainly not becoming a GM soon enough, right? So this is just aimed at people who have little time and they want to see some improvements in their chess. And that's, yeah, makes me very happy to hear that it seems to work that way.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I'm just going to talk about one example that I recently went over that really demonstrates what I think is so powerful about this course is that, like you said, you should analyze your games after you're done. I've heard that a million times, right? Who doesn't say that? Who says you shouldn't analyze your games? Nobody, right? That would be ridiculous. But what I thought was impressive is that you actually had a 17-minute video that was about how to analyze classical games. And it went into such detail of like, here's what you do when you get home from your game, when you have the limited time or in between rounds. That's like step one. And then step two is here's what you do for the deeper analysis. And I just really appreciate that you really took that time to say, like, here are the actual steps of how to analyze a game rather than just saying, just analyze games, which is, you know, what most people do. So I don't know if you want to reflect on that at all, but I was impressed that there was so much detail in how to go about doing that.
I mean, again, I'm very happy to hear it. And just to make it very clear, like anything that is in that course, usually I fucked it up throughout my career, and I had to find out how to do these things. That's why they are so detailed, right? I did things wrong, and then I was just curious, like, how can I find a way for myself that really works, that I can really stick to? Because this whole, just be perfect and always, I tried to find a way that worked for myself. And I think I'm also clear that sometimes even I didn't do these things, like, just knowing what you should do doesn't mean that you do it all the time. So this is also a difference. But most of it is really just me struggling to do things right, trying to read books, learn from other people, be it, chess people, but also just outside of chess, people have good ideas on how to learn from your losses in tennis, and you can take something from there. So I try to take things from everywhere. And it might even be that this method came up in the work with my sports psychologist, who also has a big part in all of this, because even though he didn't play any chess, he always understood the whole feeling or the mental state I'm in. And he would say, yeah, for sure, you can't analyze the whole game during a tournament when maybe in 2 hours you've got to play the next game. Like, that's just impossible. So big shout out to my sports psychologist as well.
Yeah, I felt like that really resonated with me, because that's really what I was trying to do as well, where you put stuff in there, like put your thought process in, because later you can look at the game and you can see the alternate lines. But what you can't recover is, what were you thinking there? Like, you made a giant blunder there, but why? Were you, you know, jumping at shadows? Were you distracted? Did you just miss that thing? I think it's really important to note that. So I try to like note a lot of weird stuff in my analysis. My coach will be like, so you noted here that the kid next to you started sniffling a lot here. And I'm like, yeah, it was really annoying. And he's like, well, it makes sense because you made a terrible move right here. I'm like, okay, so now I know, like, I need to refocus. Like, I can't let the sniffling bother me. You know, I've even adopted a method of putting my thumbs in my ears at the right angle that can give me the maximum amount of focus. I'm a little worried that my opponents are going to be like, how come whenever he does that, he comes up with good moves? Is he like smushing the ear plug, the transmitter device or something in his ears? But it helps me a lot to really focus in. So yeah, I found stuff like that to be very helpful in my own analysis. Whereas, like, you know, someone else might look at your game and be like, what is all this nonsense? Like, this doesn't even make sense. It doesn't affect the game. And it's like, but it affects how I approach the game and thus my own personal improvement, which I think that's an important distinction between just like lines. I would love to see like a Grandmaster Games collection where they did that. And it wasn't just the lines, but like, here I was a little hungry. And I don't know. I think that would be kind of fascinating. I imagine no Grandmaster will pull the veil back that far, but I think it would be interesting to see it.
I think it's also very hard to just have all that detail, right? Yeah, many things, I gotta say, again, I didn't do some of these things, you know, perfectly well. And I also carved out some stuff only after I finished my career. And I know so many grandmasters who basically none of it. They got very strong, but they don't really have a structured way of working on chess. They are extremely talented. They spend a lot of time on chess, but that's maybe why then their approach or what they try to teach doesn't really work, because for them, everything is logical and they have a lot of time. And it's just like, yeah, just do some chess and get better at it, I guess. And it's like, yeah, that's nice. But I think that doesn't really work for most of the people. So yeah, it's interesting. And also to your point of writing down the what you think, it's just realize that chess is a decision-making game. So we need to understand why we made a certain decision. At the end, we just need to make better decisions. Again, you don't necessarily need to know more about chess to perform better. Every one of us has stupid mistakes that might be due to sleep deficit, might be because we didn't eat, might be because the guy next to us was sniffling, might be because we had an opponent that was stinking. I mean, there's 1,000 reasons why we made stupid decisions. And if we can already stop those, then that's already quite good. But we need to know what happened during the game. It's 10 days after, no chance of remembering.
Yeah. And I have a special challenge. Every week at the club, my daughter wants to play next to me. And she plays like in a kid bracket. So there's always some kid sitting next to me who's doing something. I don't know what it is with little kids, right? Some little kid, like my daughter, just plays chess. Well, like some little kid will be either talking to her or to themselves or like banging stuff around. I'm like, what is going on over here? You guys get it together? Like yesterday, this kid checkmated my daughter and she was like, mm-hmm. And then he's like, you know, you really messed up there. You should have put your knight on that square. And she's like, yeah, I know. And he's like, well, then why didn't you? And she's like,
empathy isn't the thing yet at this age, yeah?
So it's quite funny. And I think he was trying to like stir up friendly conversation. I was like, that's not how you do that. Like, it's not a friendly conversation. Because he kept saying,
I hope he will learn something until he goes into the dating age. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He kept saying, thank you so much. It was a fun game. She's like, yeah, then why are you being so rude to me? So it was very interesting. I'm curious, what do you think is the most valuable aspect of this course? I found a lot of value in it in different areas, but I'm curious, if you had to tell someone in four sentences or something, what do you think is the most valuable thing?
The aim would be to give you a way of studying that you understand and that you can put into practice, where you don't have to second guess what you do, how you do it, and how you bring yourself to do the things. I think that's what the aim of the course is. That's the end result. People go out of the course with a plan, and they have also the possibility to ask via the Discord group any questions and to talk to other people who have same plans, similar plans, and that's the whole idea.
Yeah, and I think that is, there's so much value there in having a plan that you're happy about. And what you said even already about the rest day, I don't have a day-to-day plan. I more have this month or these 2 weeks, I want to focus on the following things. And maybe I do need to get a little bit more granular so I can schedule in something like a rest day. I think maybe that would be a good idea. Okay, let me ask you a tactics question then. Puzzle Rush. You seem pretty against Puzzle Rush. And I'm just curious because it feels like a lot of other programs are very pro Puzzle Rush, with sort of the thought that it lets you really drill those fast, easy patterns so you get a lot of pattern recognition. But it seems like you are in disagreement with that. So could you talk about maybe what it is that you think is not great about Puzzle Rush then?
Yeah, so I don't want to say that they are necessarily wrong, the other programs. I just look at it from a different point of view, maybe. So when I think about spending time on chess, I put everything in two different brackets. Put it in the enjoyment bracket or in the training bracket. And then I just try to keep it as simple as possible. So everything that is majorly focusing on getting better at chess is a training. Everything that is, first thing comes to mind is enjoyment, goes into the enjoyment bracket. The problem with Puzzle Rush, in my opinion, is that it's a bit a hybrid, and it's very easy to slip into the enjoyment bracket but feel that you are training, because you have this adrenaline of just getting the things right. So if you do Puzzle Rush perfectly, I like it as a tool. What would mean perfectly? It would be sitting there and really not only seeing the first move when you execute a move, but trying to find the whole line and only then execute the moves. And then every time you finish a 3-minute Puzzle Rush, you stop everything, you go to your mistakes, and you check, why did I make that mistake? What can I do better next time? What happens, at least what happened to me most of the time, I was just doing 2.5 hours of Puzzle Rush. I got annoyed at myself. I was stressed. I was just making the first move that seemed like a check or like a capture. I was just executing it without really thinking through. So what happens actually sometimes is you actually pattern recognize your mistakes. Ooh. Because when you do something several times in a row without correcting it in a structured way, you put that into your brain as something that is known to you. And our brain, known things, that's how marketing works, for example. So let's say McDonald's, but you don't know Burger King. Even though you don't like McDonald's, you will go to McDonald's rather than Burger King because it's something familiar. So if there is something familiar with the mistake you do all the time again, but you don't recognize it or you don't stop it, then actually during a game, you will think, that looks normal to me. That looks familiar. That's something I did already. That must be good. And then you're very happy about doing the same mistake again. So I just see that there is quite some risk with using Puzzle Rush, because I don't think that, at least for myself, again, I'm not that good in stopping myself in the moment. So I just don't do it altogether. When I see a lot of risk with a training method, I think, I think I want to get a training method like the stepped method. There is basically no risk of falling into the same pattern, because you would have to print out all the results and really have them like in one hand while solving, get the similar kind of feeling. So that's very far, but the puzzle rush can get very, very logical to do the wrong thing. That's why I don't like.
I think especially because it rewards speed, right? So it's like it actually rewards you for intuition, making the right first move, rather than like if you calculate the whole line, you just lost time. Like you just wasted time. And I think for me, especially because they start out so easy, I'm like, cool, this is easy. Boom, boom, instant move, instant move, instant move. And I usually don't slow down until I make the instant move that's wrong. And then I'm like, oh, it's actually gotten a little harder. Oh, my bad. But I will say this, I do go back and look at all the ones I missed. But yeah,
that's great.
It's my favorite is to do the survival mode, because then because it doesn't have the timed element, I feel like, okay, now I can do it for real. I can actually calculate all the lines and do it that way. So, but yeah.
Yeah. Then in my opinion, it's also, it's maybe it's still called Puzzle Rush Survival, right? But in a way, it's not rush anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Because you're not forced to go as quick as possible and to just do the first possible move. And just another little problem is that actually when then you solve tactical exercises, then later on the way you should, you actually, we talked about habits, you have the habit of not writing things down and you have the habit of making the first possible move. So you create habits that aren't great in other training or also during the game. It's not really amazing to just play the first possible move. Then why do I think, for example, some grandmasters, they swear that it's amazing to do Puzzle Rush. I can understand that, because what are they trying to do? They are trying to get better at bullet and blitz chess, and they are grandmasters. So what happens when you're extremely good, you can also on the fly understand a mistake and why you did that mistake, right? Yeah. So I can play a blitz game, and by the end of it, I probably already have a feeling of where things went wrong and what should have been done otherwise. So I have that learning already a little bit built in. But when you're not that experienced, when you're not that strong, you probably have no clue when you play without analyzing what went wrong, why did it go wrong, and what was the wrong move. So it's much harder to learn without like specifically taking the time. So I think that's also a big difference. So when you hear some very strong players saying that they like Puzzle Rush, doesn't necessarily have to be that for you the same applies.
Yeah, that makes sense. Patreon supporter Rich Burgess is wondering, and I think this kind of goes in your different buckets. Do you recommend sort of aligning different aspects of chess study or play with sort of the rhythms of the day? And I think what he means is like you're first getting up, your brain maybe is at its most active, and then at the end of the day, it's really slowed down, but you still want to do some chess. Do you think like you should structure your studies around that, or should you maybe just say only do it when your brain is doing its best?
I would say always do the hard training as early as possible. Mm-hmm. There are two reasons. One reason, you're fresh and the quality will be better. Second reason, if you did it already, you can't miss it anymore. The same. I always go to the gym in the morning. That's the first thing I do on days I go to the gym. Just so many times I thought, okay, yeah, no, let's, I have actually a lot to do for the blog. Let's just first get this done and then maybe see a friend. And then, yeah, at 7 p.m., I'll do the gym. I never go to the gym at 7 p.m. Like there's no chance I go to the gym at 7 p.m. So that's just how it works for me. And I think it works for many people. If you want to do something hard, especially maybe you don't love it as much, but you again, you know it works, do that at the beginning. Then I would say that if you really realize that your brain is not as active anymore, focus on doing enjoyment chess stuff and really don't count it as training. That's why I like the two buckets. So the biggest problem is when people do a lot of enjoyment things, but they expect to get better. That's where frustration comes from. right? They think they spend a lot of time on chess. But when I ask them, what are you actually doing? They basically only count things that are enjoyment, but they think they are doing training. So that's what you want to avoid. So then really say, in the evening, I'm just too tired to really do chess training. So I'll just lie on the sofa and I'll just watch stream. And that's great. And I enjoy myself, but I don't expect to get better because of it. Or maybe you say, when I come home from work, I have 30 minutes where I can still focus. So that's the 30 minutes that I actually do the tactic training. Everything after that is just enjoyment. I don't plan anything more. I just say, okay, if I want to do chess, I will, you know, play games. I don't analyze them, but I don't expect to get better out of it. Or I watch my favorite streamer and I don't expect to get better out of it. So I think that's like the importance, that if you do things for enjoyment, don't think that you'll get better and you'll be happy. And when you train and you put in the right time and effort, you can expect to get better, and you will if you do it the right way.
Okay, fair enough. We are quickly running out of time here. So I want to ask you a selfish question. I mean, I have to be a little selfish here. But here's my question. I have read so many books on chess, especially chess strategy. And I'm still like, I've improved. It's fine. I'm like 1700, but I'm wondering, am I making the right decision now in the last week or so to kind of shift to a, let's try to put all that knowledge into skill. And so what I've started to do is try to lean more into playing more, and analyzing my games more and tactics rather than reading about positional chess. My coach also has noted, like, oh, your positional chess is really good. Now, if you would just stop making terrible moves, like, you would be a really good chess player. So any thoughts on that? Is it time for me to just try to get my knowledge into skill? And I guess, how should I go about doing that?
100% agree about the assessment of trying to, you know, focus on the skill. I think one of my students told me that he enjoys a lot to do this strategical stuff, but he understands that tactics is the key to that. It really makes sense to study strategic, because if you still blunder pieces, you can, you know, understand the strategy of the game perfectly well, but you'll still lose. So I would definitely focus on that. I also have a rule which I talk about in the course, which is the 1/3 rule. I also have an article on that. So the 1/3 rule should make it easy to come up with a good training plan. And I say that 1/3 of the time you should study tactics and solve tactical exercises. 1/3 of the time you should play and analyze games. And whenever you play games, you should also think about a time that you analyze, right? So don't say, I have 1 hour today, I will play for 1 hour, but play for 40 minutes and 20 minutes you will have to analyze those games. And then the last third can be either end game, opening, or strategy. So this way you really realize, okay, the most important things are tactics and playing and analyzing. So that's what I would really recommend. And even if you feel that you're very good in strategic play, you can also leave that out for half a year. And you just, in the third, you just focus on openings or some end game, or even you say, okay, I don't need that at all. I just want to do tactics and playing. That's fine. Like, if you do those two things, improvement will be there. That's the two things that are really necessary if you want to get better.
Okay. It's hard for me though. I really like reading about positional chess. It makes me feel like I'm getting better, right? I know the other two things actually make me better, but getting knowledge makes me be like, look how smart I am about chess. And then it's like, well, how come when you play, you just make bad moves?
Yeah. That's the whole problem of acquiring as much knowledge as possible is, as you say, it's, first of all, it's also a little bit easier because, again, it's the teaching style. You can be a little bit more laid back. It's not my brain just working, oh my God, which move do I have to play? And then secondly, it's also, I actually learned something new today. Because if you solve, let's go back to the tactical solving, right? It can be quite frustrating trying to do this exact same motif for the 30th time, and you think, yeah, I get it. Like, yeah. If somebody tells me there is a fork, I'll find the fork. Yeah, but the point is that you have to repeat that all the time to actually find the fork during the game, which is, you can go to any other sports. Like in basketball, they are training free throws like crazy, right? It's not that they don't know how to shoot it. They just want to be sure that they really, really, really are quite sure that they will get it in the game. So it's a little bit the harder work. And I think of thinking about it, I would just say that for the moment, everything you do for chess strategy is chess enjoyment. So you can do that on your sofa, you know, however you like. Just enjoyment. But when you do it, you don't expect to get better at all. Again, back to this point. So when you write a training plan, there is no strategy at all. And if additionally to that plan, you still have time and you want to spend it on chess, then just read a book. But be aware that that's probably not where the improvement is coming from, specifically for you also, because you're already that good.
Yeah, I think that's hard for me, because like coming from academia, it's like amassing knowledge is what my brain is trained to think is wisdom. Like there's no part of academia where they're like, okay, now you must translate into a competition. Like, two academics enter a room, only one will survive. Like, we don't do that. So yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And again, it always depends on your end goal, but if you wanna be better during the competition, then there needs to be some skills. If you just, like, there might be somebody listening and saying, hey, I just love chess and I want to understand more. So when I watch a game of other players, I get what they're doing. Okay, then you don't need to do the skills. If you don't want to play yourself, right? If you don't want to excel, you can leave these things up. But if you want to get better, and if you're happy to see your rating rise and oh my God, there is some improvement and I'm actually finding better moves, I don't blunder my queen anymore, I win my one positions. If you want these kind of feelings, then the best way to get there is to do the harder things that aren't as fun, but later on you will get the fun by winning the games, by feeling that you did actually good.
Yeah, I guess a decent sports analogy might be like, if I enjoyed tennis, I could read a lot of books on how to serve and watch videos, and then I could watch professionals do it and be like, they're doing it all wrong. But if I don't go out on the court and practice serving, I will not be able to serve.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a amateur tennis player with a horrible serve, I can say in theory, it's much easier to serve than when you're standing there and the guy's yelling at you like, no, your feet are not right. And I'm like, oh my God. So yeah, I mean, it's for everyone the same. And just, yeah. I try to apply the same things when I do try to learn other skills or skills in other areas. And again, I don't always do it perfectly, but at least I understand when I do it badly and I'm like, yeah, you're too lazy. Okay, it's your own fault. What can you do?
Well, Noel, I wish we had another 6 hours. I'm just going to be real here. So we're going to have to do this again sometime, but I know I have to go. I imagine you have a busy day ahead of, maybe not a busy day ahead of you. Maybe you're going to bed. I don't know. We are in very different time zones.
Dinner time for me.
Dinner time. Okay. So if people want to follow up with you, what's the best way to reach you?
By email. You can just write me an email at noel@nextlevelchess.blog. I read all the emails myself. And if it's not just three words, I also answer to them. So yeah, if you have any questions about the conversation, just let me know. And yeah, I also am on Twitter, but if you want to write to me, much better to write an email. Because Twitter DMs, they get lost sometimes, or I just don't look at them that often.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been incredibly insightful. Make sure you check out Noel's blog. Again, if you're interested in this course, which really, if you enjoy podcasts, I mean, this course is pretty great. Like, once I realized I could just listen to this course as a podcast, it kind of really expanded the times I could have it. No, like at first I was like, this has to replace chess improvement time. And I realized, like, no, this can be like replacing podcast time. Oh, wait, am I encouraging you not to listen to the Chess Journeys podcast? Maybe I am. Maybe that's the answer. Stop listening to this podcast. Maybe that's the key to everything. But if you want to check out the program, there will be a link in the show notes. You can use the code Chess Journeys. And if you do use it, let me know how it goes. I know for myself, I've been enjoying it. I hope this is the week where you all have your tremendous ratings gains. And if not, don't worry. Plateauing is the norm. We're all working hard, and you'll get there soon. And I will see you all next time. Goodbye, everybody.